Welcome to the Peaceful Revolutions and the Light Publishing's audio presentation of the book Christianity, A Successful Failure, Finding Light in an Age of Darkness. Read by Tim Spies. Preface. This book is first and foremost an existential adventure and challenge, meaning it will encourage and enable the reader or listener to question basic life views that we all hold and that most of us have been taught to believe are true. Trying to find the best answers to life's most important questions is required if you want to live a complete life and find deeper meaning and truth in this life. Questions like, is it reasonable to believe I evolved from hydrogen gas? Can mere physical chemicals reasonably account for my ability to know right from wrong or to know and experience forgiveness? Is love merely an emotion? What is the purpose of human life? What is the purpose of my life? What is truly important in life? What am I as a human being? How do I value things and why? What am I truly living for, and is it actually valuable? If there is a higher form of love and I can experience a life where I give and receive that love with others on a daily basis, does Christianity truly represent God well? If Christianity is wrong, what do I do about my guilt? In sum, this book is about answering the question, what view makes the best sense of the reality that I experience and answers best the question about what I am and what is truly valuable? You might ask why I need to address Christianity in order to answer that question, and the book will make that clear. The simple truth is that the vast majority of people merely go along with the program given to them by others, usually parents or religious leaders or other significants, and complain when it doesn't go their way. Sadly, they never ask those questions, or if they do, they give up easily and never diligently pursue satisfying answers. Answers that pass the test of reason and logic. Answers that lead to good and positive change. As one might be able to tell from the title, I am not a Christian, although I was one for years. If you have not been exposed to Christian concepts, that is very good, although you would be very unusual indeed, since Christians and their God beliefs have been spread all over the earth. This book is not coming from nor defending a Christian worldview. In fact, it is challenging many of the beliefs that Christians say are true. It is challenging Christianity itself, as Christianity is defined by its religious leaders and authorities. Really, the book can be entitled Religion, A Successful Failure, since Christianity is not unique in its failures, but really mirrors the other world religions like Islam or Judaism. However, since I was raised as a Christian, and then, after a genuine conversion experience as an adult, spent many years involved in and committed to the Christian system, it is appropriate I focus specifically on Christian religion. In other words, the criticism of, oh well, he doesn't have any practical knowledge or experience with Christianity, would be false. As we shall see, that criticism is largely fallacious anyway, since I don't need experience to judge whether most things are true or false. Reading this book will take some courage if you do so sincerely with a willingness to learn or change. If you read this book with a defensive shield on, then no courage is required and you are wasting your time. If you are a Christian, this book will be very challenging. I hope you will discover that I am not unfair or mean-spirited in my corrections and in identifying the things that are wrong with Christianity. My approach in this respect should remove the temptation to make the unfair accusation that it is my bitterness or bad experiences with Christians or the church or some other such incorrect thing that is the motivation for this book. The fact is, the motivation for this book is to bring desperately needed and beneficial change to many people, including Christians who see their need. There are very many good and well-intentioned Christians who spend time sincerely helping people. This book takes nothing away from their personal effort to help other people, unless, of course, the primary way they view helping others is to get them to believe wrong Christian doctrine or to participate in religious rituals or foolish expenditures of resources. If you are an atheist, non-theist, or agnostic, this book should be of particular interest to you. Many non-theists and agnostics have legitimate gripes against Christianity and Christians and have correctly identified wrong beliefs and practices. However, if you are going to try and use this book as fodder for your canon against the existence of God, you should be surprised how that will not work if you use reason and observation well, the tools you properly extol. I urge you to evaluate all possibilities of what can be true about human life and not filter out possibilities that you don't like or don't currently fit your worldview. Hopefully, we can agree that one characteristic of a good person is one who will try and be fair and as objective as possible. The important term objective is defined as follows. Expressing or dealing with facts or conditions as perceived without distortion by personal feelings, prejudice, or interpretations, or not influenced by personal beliefs or feelings, fair or real, or of a person or their judgment, not influenced by personal feelings or opinions in considering and representing facts. Being as objective as possible is extremely important in evaluating anything. If the reader has noticed, people's concern with being objective is becoming an increasingly rare thing, so you will have to be different and concerned about being objective. Equally important to trying to be as objective as possible is that we acknowledge that we all have a world and/or existential view that has components of personal beliefs, feelings, biases, prejudices, opinions, etc., and that world or existential view can cause us to have undue bias against other views. Part of this author's job in writing this book is to attempt to put aside my personal bias, feelings, etc., in as much as that is possible, and thus to be as objective as possible. Ultimate or absolute reality does exist, and the more objective we are, the more we will not be afraid to apply the extremely valuable tools of observation, reason, and logic to the necessary pursuit of finding, discovering, clarifying, and understanding that reality. A word about science. Many believe that science is the sure and sole realm of truth that will solve humankind's problems. This is an erroneous view, as we shall see. Science, empirical science, deals with the physical realm and is practiced in the present. Some of the most important concepts regarding human existence are outside the physical realm, namely love, forgiveness, compassion, justice, etc. Science is a very valuable tool and practice, and practicing science can solve many human problems. However, it is inadequate and impotent to solve the most important human problems that exist, which problems cause human conflict, abuse, and neglect, and all the evils associated with those realities. Finally, a few comments about the book format and style. I have endeavored to keep the content of this book as simple as possible. I have concluded that simplicity conveys truth in the fullest and clearest manner possible. In order to help the reader get what I am trying to convey, I have included both opening chapter questions as well as chapter summaries. The purpose of the opening chapter questions is to help the listener or reader to start to consider what the chapter addresses and bring their attention and focus on those topics. The purpose of the chapter summaries is to repeat in a very clear and concise way the main concepts being conveyed in the chapters. One of the benefits of having these opening chapter questions and chapter summaries is if a particular chapter does not interest you, you can still follow the flow of the book just by reading the question and summary. New introduction section. The purpose of this book. I hope the reader likes illustrations because I'm going to use quite a few of them. The purpose of my previous book was to take the lamp out of the closet and put the lamp on the table so people could see by it. However, people are not making it into the room to see the lamp and the things in the room, but instead are being kept in or led into the house next door because this house has really cool lights and is very attractive. The lamp in the first house, the life-giving one that can clearly help people see clearly, is a simple, bright, clear, warm light. In addition, the first house has many mirrors in it, and the bright, clear light really helps people see what is in the mirrors. It can be a bit disconcerting since it shows things in the room, including the people, as we really are. People who stay in this house grow and blossom just like plants and flowers exposed to the sun. The light in the house next door, however, is made of many colors and flashes and pulses, a lot like the lights in Las Vegas. The house was built on purpose right next to the house with the bright, clear light. People who are in this house stagnate, don't grow and slowly wither, just like the plants that don't get enough sun. Next to both houses is a lot of darkness, a cold, chilling darkness. Many are standing in that dark, cold lot because they went into the house with the multicolored lights and experienced the hypocrisy and lovelessness of those who dwell there, and rightfully ran out. Now they are just frightened of houses with lights, and so they are not willing to go into the house with the simple, bright, clear, warm light. So they stay in the dark, cold lot, which causes their spirits and hearts to get cold as well. The purpose of the house with the many colored lights is to draw people away from the house with the bright, clear, warm light. The lights in the Las Vegas house distorts things and makes things in the room somewhat difficult to see, fuzzy and unclear. There are very few mirrors in this house, and the ones that are there distort in a favorable way the image of the people looking into it. It is very attractive to people, so they journey towards the house with the bright, clear light, which light can really help them, but which light shows them things that they do not or may not want to see, so they are easily distracted and drawn by the cool, multicolored, entertainment, luring alternative. The vast majority end up in the house with the cool, flashy lights and stay there. Unfortunately, one of the effects of staying in this house is that people's spirits shrivel and die there. This book is about the house with the flashy cold lights and how it is different than the house with the bright, clear, warm light. Thus, the book's purpose is to fairly fully describe the flashy lighted house and to thus expose its true nature, and by exposing its nature and purpose, to encourage people to go over to the house with the bright, clear, warm light. This author spent many years in the flashy, lighted house before I made my way out, and so is very familiar with it. This author's hope is that as people use reason well to understand and acknowledge the nature of the flashy, lighted house, that they might leave that house with the flashy, cold, radioactive, disorienting light and enter the house with the pure, bright, warm, clear, life-giving light. Furthermore, and in addition to drawing people away from the multicolored lights house, this book is intended to draw people out of the dark, cold, empty lot that many are standing in next to the houses. If they are willing to step inside, they will find that the pure, bright, warm light, the life-giving light, will give them everything that they are looking for. Introduction. A successful failure? The phrase successful failure has been used before, perhaps most recently, and in the most popular fashion in the story about the Apollo 13 moon mission. If you have seen the movie or story, it is about NASA's attempt to land yet another manned space mission on the moon. As the story goes, there is a large failure with the oxygen tank on the way to the moon, which not only makes landing on the moon impossible, but getting the astronauts back to Earth improbable. With much effort, they managed to get those three astronauts back to Earth safely. Thus, it was called NASA's most successful failure mission, meaning the mission to land on the moon was a failure, but getting the three men back safely was a success. So you might be wondering about what is a successful failure, especially in the context of a major world religion. How can a world religion be a success or failure? Well, let's refer back to the Apollo 13 mission. There were two perspectives which account for the two terms, successful and failure. From NASA's perspective, the mission was a failure. It did not accomplish its objective of landing on the moon. From the wives and children and friends of the astronauts' perspective, the mission was a success. Their loved ones returned to them. Now, what if there was a space exploration organization higher than NASA and with more knowledge and information than NASA who said, "We don't want you to send a mission to the moon, for that is largely a waste of time and resources." What if NASA didn't listen and send the moon mission anyway? Given the higher body who knows what is best, asked NASA not to do that mission, in what way could it be considered a success even if the mission objectives were accomplished? The people at NASA would be high-fiving one another yelling success, while the wiser ones who asked NASA not to send the mission at all would be despondent, knowing, in truth, the mission was a failure. It is about different perspectives and what is ultimately valuable. The Christianity mission is a successful failure, but the success and failure aspects of it are due to the view of two different people with two very different perspectives. The two perspectives are Christian leadership versus Jesus or Joshua of Nazareth. I will be referring to the historical person of Jesus of Nazareth as Joshua of Nazareth in this book for the following reasons. First, it is a better English translation of the Hebrew name of the historical person than Jesus. The name Jesus is the result of a Hebrew to Greek to English translation. The name Joshua is a result of a Hebrew to English translation. Second, because the term Jesus or phrase Jesus Christ carries with it an inordinate amount of erroneous religious baggage, so I would prefer not to encourage that baggage to download into the minds of those who listen or read this book. In other words, when I say the word Jesus to a religious person, depending upon which of the thousands of sects they belong to, they will bring to their mind the Jesus that their sect created and indoctrinated them into instead of the real and historical person of Joshua of Nazareth. The term success in the title, Christianity, a Successful Failure, is being judged by normal world standards. The concept of success is normally defined by the vast majority of the people of the earth as involving the gaining, possessing, or controlling of money or wealth, and having many people backing the work, and the leaders exercising authority or power or control over those many people. Would you not agree? Entities that could be judged as successful can range from individuals to organizations to businesses to governments, etc. The term failure in the title, according to normal world standards, would be the opposite of successful. So a person or entity which does not accumulate, possess, or control material wealth, nor does that person exercise authority or control over others, would be judged as a failure or a nobody. This is especially so if the person or entity is judged as exceptional or very capable of accomplishing success. From a pure principle standpoint, failure means the lack of accomplishing stated goals or objectives. Is the reader with me so far? Two different perspectives, the perspective of Christian leadership versus the perspective of Joshua of Nazareth. This book will, in part, explain why the real historical person of Joshua of Nazareth would judge contemporary Christian and Bible religion as a failure and those who practice it as failing. For the readers who don't believe it is possible to know what the perspective of the real historical person of Joshua of Nazareth is, or that it is not likely that his deeds and words were successfully captured and preserved in the four small books called the Gospels, please read Section 6, Objections to the Solution. Therefore, a successful failure means that one standard, the average person on the earth, including Christian leaders in the vast majority of religious people, sees or judges something as successful, while another standard, the person of Joshua of Nazareth and those who agree with him, sees or judges the same thing as a failure. That something, of course, is the religion of Christianity, or the people who claim to be some flavor of Christian, or who claim to make up or be part of the church. Some will yell divisiveness at the previous statements. I counter that some division is good and necessary, and some is bad and harmful. For example, if you have 100 people and some believe that violence is a good and right means to get their way, whilst others believe that reason and nonviolent means are the best course, there needs to be a division among those people, and that division would be good and necessary. The successful mission of that which calls itself the church is to have larger, more powerful congregations of people and thus become a force controlling more people in a community, society, or nation, a voice proclaiming a religious, moral, or political agenda that people adopt. While many, if most, religious leaders will deny this claim and instead claim something like, "Our main goal is to bring people to Christ," their actions and words betray their claim as false. As this book will demonstrate, they are not looking to the historical person of Joshua of Nazareth as their leader. Instead, their Christ is an ever-changing talisman which Christians create and whose purpose is in general to give the people what they want, not what is real and thus what they really need. The successful mission of Joshua of Nazareth for his followers is to transform individual people's lives for the better, and thus we become the collective model for how human beings are supposed to live, together, by love, for truth, and rightness. Even at this early stage of the book, the reader should see some contrast between the two goals or missions. There is no doubt that Christianity is successful from the perspective of what people in general consider success. It has about 2.25 billion human beings, or about 31% of the Earth's population, who somehow identify with or take some Christian label or are a member in one of its thousands of divisions or sects. Those who call themselves Christians and who control the organizations and resources of the church have many billions of dollars at their disposal and hundreds of millions of people they control or heavily influence. From the world's perspective of money and control over people, the church is extremely successful. Furthermore, the United States of America, the most powerful and influential nation in the past century, was influenced by Christians and their beliefs, as is also true with most European nations, including the United Kingdom. Clearly, the leaders of those nations are currently turning away from even Christian ethics, let alone Christian existential beliefs. The question, however, for those who actually care is, how does Joshua of Nazareth define successful? This book will look at and contrast what the world considers successful versus what Joshua of Nazareth considers successful. In doing this, we will support the proposition that Christianity, and by its inference, its adherence, is a successful failure. Some would say it is impossible to evaluate a world religion objectively or from a perspective of successfulness or failure. My response is, why? If we have a standard that we can agree on, whether it be a standard of measure like the English or metric system, or standard of performance like the time for running a marathon, or the claims of a religion like God is in control, then anything can be evaluated with conclusions drawn as to true or false, right or wrong, success or failure, including many religious claims and practices. Our tools of observation, reason, and logic enable this. If Christianity claims that believing in its God will lead to something important, like lives better lived, then all we need to do is look at the factors, things that Christianity claims are benefits, and evaluate them against people's experiences and lives. More fundamentally, if Christians claim that their God beliefs are based on the person they call Jesus Christ, then it is a relatively simple task to compare the Christian beliefs and practices against the teachings of Joshua of Nazareth as they were preserved in the four gospel books. This latter evaluation we will do. Some would seek to deny that Christian religion is successful. I would ask the reader to look at the wealth of the Roman Catholic Church and, according to the world's definition of successful, make the case that it is not. Look at the Vatican property with the Sistine Chapel and the worldwide properties just the Roman Catholic religion controls and conclude, oh, they don't control much wealth. I would ask the reader to look at the control and power the Roman Catholic wields over people and then find people who will conclude, oh, that is not a successful organization. Look at the wealth and power the Roman Catholic religious system wields in the U.S., the expensive religious buildings and the health systems they control, and make a case that it is not successful. Look at the wealth of all of the other Bible-based Christian sects on the earth and the money they have invested in their buildings, the crystal cathedrals, etc., and property and programs and businesses and media empires, TBN, for example. The Protestants also own their share of expensive health systems. Christians who are not part of these large organizations will object, saying, oh, we are not like them. We are just a small local church. Well, the fact is that the small religious organizations are just like the large ones, with few significant differences. The beliefs, routines, rituals, and most importantly, people's lifestyles are the same. The only difference is the size of the organization. It is much the same as Lowe's or Home Depot versus the local Ace Hardware. The operation and purpose are the same no matter if you are Lowe's or Ace Hardware, with just a few minor differences separating the two. Collectively, large or small, look at the power that the leaders of the Bible-based Christian sects wield over tens of millions of people. Can you look at them and conclude that, oh no, They are not successful organizations according to how the world defines successful. There are Christian religious organizations, what people call churches, near this author who take in millions of dollars of people's money each month with budgets of over $50 million per year. You may not like what they stand for, but not liking what they stand for does not nullify the objective truth that they are successful according to the world's definition of success. The vast majority of small businesses and some middle-sized companies in the U.S. do not generate millions of dollars of revenue like the many hundreds of Christian religious organizations in the U.S. do, and that statement excludes the U.S. Roman Catholic system. The simple fact is the church is powerful and successful according to the world's standards. In great contrast, now look at the man who, some 2,000 years ago, walked the earth and accumulated no material wealth, did not hold any positions of earthly power or earthly authority, did not seek to control material wealth nor to take from people, but only to give to them and help them in the deepest, most meaningful ways possible. For doing that, publicly, for about 3 years, he is rejected and killed by the people. That is his success story, which most people would call a failure. The contrast could not be any sharper. This book will clarify that simple contrast. New introduction section entitled Religion-Based Morality versus Existential Truth. History has reached a point in the U.S. where there are no obvious groups related moral injustices against certain groups of people. That makes it hard to find good fights to join, like the civil rights movement in the 60s. The moral enemy is no longer primarily in the seats of government power or even in the corporate offices. Rather, the enemy is the individual and the turning away from a common ethic to irrational, selfish emotionalism instead, turning away from an absolute view of reality to a relativistic view of reality. Please understand that this book does not condemn Christians or Biblians. Rather, it seeks to correct them using the best standard possible. This author is well aware of the following simple truth and hopes others will come to this awareness as well. That God condemns no one. Rather, we condemn ourselves. Please listen to that again and understand the truth it conveys. God condemns no one. Rather, we condemn ourselves. God merely created the organisms, beings, and the systems or rules to allow us to both choose our after-death destiny. A great weakness of the non-theist existential view is the lack of ultimate justice. For example, it should be an offense to the reader that Hitler and Mother Teresa would have the same after-death experience, even if that experience is simply self-consciousness annihilation. The conscience that we have should be repulsed at the thought that Adolf Hitler and Mother Teresa would have the same ultimate destiny. Our conscience should choke at that possibility. Why is that? The concept of condemning ourselves is much like the U.S. legal system, at least how it is supposed to be. Legislators create the laws that people are to abide by. A judge's role is to determine whether an individual broke the law or not. If the judge finds that the person broke the law, the punishment is also often prescribed by rules or law. Therefore, in an imperfect system, in a perfect system, the only people receiving consequences, ramifications, or punishment for their wrong behavior are those who did something wrong. They broke a law, rule, policy, etc. The person is not before the judge because the judge didn't like them and wanted them to be there. Rather, the person who committed the wrong called for the consequence. As an example, the person who murdered another person deserves the consequence, including being accountable for the life they wrongly took. And so it is with God and the system he created. God does not look down and say, "I don't like you. I'm going to punish you because I just want to." In fact, it is just the opposite. God looks down and says, "Please stop destroying yourselves. Don't you know that I love you?" When a person rejects trying to live by love and thus practices wrong, the person who committed the wrong will stand before God, and God will merely validate the facts surrounding the choices made and the wrongs committed. We will address further aspects of this line of thought later in the book. There are many good, decent, moral people who are Christians. However, there are many good, decent, moral people who are agnostics, or non-theists, or Muslims, or Jews, or Buddhists, etc. In fact, my experience has been that, in general, religious people, including Christians, want what is good and right according to some religious moral standard. Having some moral standard is better than having no moral standard, unless, of course, you ignore it or use it to benefit oneself, since human beings are certainly not naturally predisposed to exemplary behavior, and in fact, are naturally predisposed to selfish behavior. Thus, having a moral standard does help restrain and constrain bad behavior. To deny this is irrational. Furthermore, and by definition, a religious moral standard includes the concept that God is the giver of the moral standard, and that God will hold people accountable to that moral standard. Stated another way, people who hold to religious moral standard believe that there will be after physical life consequences for our behavior, and that God will be the judge for deciding those consequences. The conclusion, in fact, is that some religious moral standards, within the group that holds them, have played an important role in constraining harmful, destructive, or evil behavior. Some rules of behavior, ethics, are necessary, and religion has provided them. Religion becomes destructive, and religious moral standards are tossed aside or negatively modified to conform to the desire of the group, when separate groups with competing or different God claims enter into conflict with one another. This happens because the one people group says to the other, "God is on our side, and so it is right to use any means necessary to make you guys submit to our true God." In other words, the God rules only apply to us, not them, because they don't believe in our God. Some examples of interreligious conflict would include the Crusades between Christians and Muslims, or the current conflict between Buddhists and Muslims in Indonesia. A recent example of intra-religious conflict would be the murderous conflict between the Protestants and Catholics in Ireland, or between the Shiite and Sunni Muslims. However, one does not have to reach the point of violence to lack true peace. We humans are only too good at hating one another long before we raise our fist. For example, the thousands of Bible-based Christian sects who excommunicated each other, and thus account for many of those thousands of sects, divisions, denominations, are hardly at peace and unity. While it is true they are no longer killing each other regularly as heretics in most places, nor is there large-scale open animosity between the sects, it is equally true that they are not unified, and certainly their members do not love one another, unless you redefine love as mere civility or cold politeness, as we shall see later. If it is true that human beings are predisposed to negative or harmful beliefs and behavior, and taking into consideration the facts of history, it is the most reasonable belief, then how do you think people are going to do with no moral standard and no concept of accountability for one's behavior in this life? All one has to do is look at the people of the United States here in the early 21st century, for example, and the conclusion should be obvious. As the people of the U.S. move away from a belief that God exists and will hold people accountable for how they live their lives, the following is happening. Increasing racial conflict, violent political riots, harmful drug use increasing every year, suicide increasing every year, government corruption and waste increasing each year, corporate greed increasing each year, and the list goes on and on. Those things are the fruit of a people, in this example the U.S. citizens, throwing away a common moral standard, which standard was derived from religion, upon which they agreed to live by or respect to some degree in times past. There is a correlation between the increase in immorality in the United States and the passing away of religious-derived or absolute moral standards. Of course there is, and it does not take some million-dollar government study or some think tank research to rightly judge that. Most of the animosity between the two primary political ideologies of liberal and conservative is due to ethics-based differences, or what they label as social issues, code language for ethical or moral differences. However, this book is definitely not going to make a case for why nations or societies need some religiously based moral standard in order to function well. For the religious or a primarily morally concerned person, that is probably a sacrilegious statement. But therein lies a fundamental error of religious people. The simple fact is that a moral standard, including religious-based ones like Mosaic, only works to constrain evil. It does not produce love and the critically important things associated with love. Nor does a moral standard produce hope or a good reason or purpose for living one's life. Those things require something else, something greater. This is not to say that I don't believe the people of the U.S. desperately need some common moral or ethical standard in order to reduce conflict and find unity again. They do. I will address in this book the fact that the root problems of conflict in this nation is not political ideologies, but something deeper, a changing existential view of human existence. Christianity, and by extension Christians, are significantly wrong about many things about God, but that does not mean that Christians are going to hell because of their wrong beliefs. Let me get that right out at the beginning. Sadly, for many Christians, a person having wrong beliefs about God is generally considered to be worthy of hell, but that heaven or hell based on merely religious beliefs thinking is one of the most harmful and wrong beliefs that Christians teach and hold. In fact, it has been one of the most powerful fear-motivating beliefs in all of history, capturing billions of souls to do the will of the religious leadership. Today, it serves as a powerful fear motivator to dissuade or prevent discussing different views of God or of our soul's destiny or the purpose of one's life. This is not a book condemning anyone. Rather, we often condemn ourselves, and then often wrongly. People who have wrong beliefs about things, including about God, are not sent to hell for that. Rather, beliefs are only one factor in determining one's destiny. Some beliefs are more important than others because they either gently guide or drive our behavior and lifestyle. Some beliefs do not affect our daily conduct much at all. Beliefs about the extent of the universe, or beliefs about the soil composition of Mars, or how many angels can fit on the head of a pin, really have little or no power to shape our behavior. The same can be said for many God beliefs. Many God beliefs have no bearing on how we live our lives, such as where God exists, or the exact process of our soul's journey from our body to God, or how many angels attend God, etc. However, there are some God beliefs that do have a bearing on how we conduct ourselves each day and therefore have a larger impact on our eternal destiny. The most basic God belief is to answer the question, does God exist? If that question is answered yes by an individual, perhaps the next most important God-related questions are, who is God, and what is God like, and what does he want of me or us? How am I to live my life? Will I be accountable for how I live my life? Is there something better than fear to lift me above the accountability concern? Aside from whether God exists or not, which is a more fundamental level question, if we believe God does exist, then certainly what God is like and what he wants of us are paramount, especially if God has set up a system that allows us to determine our after physical death destiny. Beliefs, faith, and religion are not the same, and we shall cover that important distinction later in the book. People of all time and of all races and all cultures and religions have asked the reasonable questions. Who created me? What is he or she like? And what does he or she want of me? Religious leaders then race in to try and answer those questions, and the average person is only too quick to listen to them and even pay them for their opinions. The religious leaders and their followers then build impressive institutions or organizations to hide the fact that many of their God beliefs are often merely opinions that do not stand the test of reason, logic, or observation. And what is the typical reason given as to why the people should consider the religious leaders as an authority about God? Well, they include things like, well, he or she was called of God, or they have a degree from seminary, or they are anointed of God, or he or she graduated magna cum laude from the best theological college, or the Holy Spirit called them, or he is a really good man, or he or she is just so-and-so's religious daughter, son or daughter, or other such irrelevant things. A critical question in this regard is, are these valid reasons to believe that religious leaders know God? This is a very important question, and we shall look at that later. Given the division among the Bible Christian religious sects, by some estimates tens of thousands of division sects, I would suggest that those leaders are not doing a good job. But you should ask, what is your standard to make that judgment? Good question. In my Finding Life video series, I make the case that the best person in history to tell us about God is the one who defeated death to prove that all he said and did was true. That person is Joshua of Nazareth, and you can read his story and teachings in my book, The Light of the World, The Life and Teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. That historical person, Joshua of Nazareth, says regarding his followers' unity, quote, Father, I pray that they may be one as we are one, unquote. Clearly, the will of Joshua and the one he calls Father is for his followers to be unified as one, not as thousands of divided, largely loveless, bickering groups of people. And yet that is exactly what exists on the earth today representing Christianity. So there you have it. This author's standard to be able to make a correct judgment about the state of Christianity's unity is the one whom all Christian sects point to as their supposed God, an expert about God. I will use the same standard to reveal how Christianity is a successful failure. There is another teaching of Joshua of Nazareth that serves to prove the claim of this book is true. In fact, of all the teachings he only gave one he labeled as a command, meaning it is of paramount importance. As we shall see, that command plays a large role in the successful failure that is Christianity. Again, this book is not about condemning anyone. We do that well enough to ourselves. This book is about people finding truth and thus hope and becoming change agents in this sad, dark world, which desperately needs positive change. Thus, this book will not be a scary experience for those who can overcome their fear or self-pride regarding exploring God beliefs or basic existential beliefs. If you don't have self-pride or fear as your shield against truth, that is, you are willing to go where reason and logic take you, then this book can provide an extremely beneficial and possibly life-changing experience.